So today I'm going to talk about a few interrelated issues concerning the banking system, not quite as interrelated as that picture, but namely collateral, funding and liquidity. So the financial crisis brought into sharp relief the liabilities side of a financial institution's balance sheet, that is, its funding structure. This had been previously somewhat neglected, but the fates of Northern Rock, Bear and Lehman's were clearly affected by the nature of their funding. So while their funding structure played a significant part in the downfall of those institutions, I would argue that the ultimate concern was about the quality of their assets, not their funding. The funding problems were symptomatic of concerns about asset quality. And in my view, the pendulum has swung too far in focusing on liabilities in the current debate, and such a swing is evident in the proposed change to Standard & Poor's rating methodology for the global banking system. Their proposed new methodology shifts the assessment of financial strength of an institution markedly towards funding and away from asset quality. In my view, asset quality should still be paramount and should be given a far larger weight than liabilities in assessing financial strength, along with the extent of leverage. So the solvency of any bank, first and foremost, is a function of the quality and value of its assets. This is, of course, true of any entity, but it is particularly true for banks because of the implications asset quality has for liquidity and because of the leverage nature of financial institutions. So the crux of my argument today is this. If I'm a creditor of a bank, my due diligence should be spent mostly on assessing the asset side of the bank's balance sheet and determining whether or not I'll get repaid in full. If asset quality remains high, I should be confident of being repaid. So financial institutions prior to the crisis had been in what might be described as an asset-driven world. Banks grew their asset portfolio on the assumption, which was generally realised, that the funding required would be easily forthcoming to support the asset growth. So to paraphrase Field of Dreams, the financial environment was, if you lend it, they will fund. That environment has been turned on its head by the financial crisis. Financial institutions are now in a funding-driven world. They can no longer assume that the funding will be readily forthcoming at a given price. We are now much more in a liability-driven world. So it's true that the structure and maturity profile of liabilities does bear close analysis. And because banks are in the business of maturity transformation, liabilities mature at a faster pace than assets. Assets can be difficult to liquefy in the market, particularly in stressed circumstances. As a result, a bank generally meets the need to repay its liabilities as they fall due by issuing more debt. But the bank's ability to refinance its maturing liabilities still fundamentally depends on the asset portfolio. An investor's decision as to whether it will be willing to lend to the institution will be based on its credit assessment of the institution's assets, not its liabilities. If there are doubts about the quality of that asset portfolio, a bank will find it considerably more difficult to obtain more funding. So let me now focus more directly on the important relationship between asset quality and liquidity. So if a bank is experiencing a problem of illiquidity, the state of its asset portfolio is even more paramount. This relates to one of the fundamental tenets of central banking, most famously associated with Badgett. So writing in Lombard Street back in 1873, Badgett states, and I'm going to go through this in a fair bit of detail, that central banks should lend freely, that is liberally, not for free, at a high rate to solvent but illiquid banks that have good collateral. So let me break that statement down and go through it in a bit more detail. So starting at the end of the statement, and germane to my argument thus far, is that the bank must have good collateral. Therefore, critically, it is the asset side of the balance sheet which enables the bank to overcome a problem on the liability side. The central bank must be sure that it is lending against good collateral. The second aspect of the statement which bears further discussion is that the central bank should lend to solvent but illiquid banks. I don't see this as being materially separable from the collateral issue. A bank's solvency is most strongly influenced by the quality of its collateral. Obviously, capital and leverage play an important role too, but it basically all boils down to the asset side again. So it's sometimes said that it might be difficult to determine whether the issue really is one of solvency rather than one of liquidity. Clearly, the fact that a liquidity issue has arisen may well be a signal that the market has concerns about solvency. Hence, the central bank should certainly be mindful of that. But the experience of the past few years demonstrates that liquidity crises can arise because of uncertainties that are exacerbated by funding structures which are heavily skewed to the short term, regardless of asset quality. But, in keeping with my argument thus far, it behoves the central bank to look through those uncertainties to the underlying asset quality of the institution under question and be prepared to lend secured against quality assets if the situation warrants. This is particularly true when there is systemic uncertainty, that is, counterparty risk aversion increases. So obviously such instances have arisen on a number of occasions in the past few years. As I've said before, in those circumstances, the central bank acts not so much as the lender of last resort, but as intermediary of last resort. Participants in the market are uneasy about lending to each other at any price, secured or unsecured, because of concerns about the solvency of the counterparty. The central bank can refrain from participating in that risk aversion and intermediate this process across its own balance sheet, thereby ameliorating the tensions created by the shortage of liquidity in the market. So the central bank can lend secured to one counterparty and take the funds or receive funds from another counterparty and lend it out secured to a third counterparty when the two of them won't deal with each other directly. So together with the provision of liquidity, there also may be a need for the central bank or prudential regulator to provide information about the quality of banks' balance sheets to reduce the uncertainties that pervade. So one could characterise the stress test conducted in the US in the middle of 2009 as an example of this. Moreover, by providing the liquidity against collateral, the central bank is indicating its confidence in the solvency of the institution. The final aspect of Badgett's statement is that lending should be at a high rate. But a higher rate than what? So a relevant benchmark is the rate at which the central bank provides liquidity in its normal operations. So in the Reserve Bank's case, that is a rate which is a small spread, normally less than 10 basis points, to the cash rate. Emergency liquidity provision, obviously, would need to be higher than this. Otherwise, institutions would avail themselves of this source of liquidity all the time, even in normal times. So the central bank should be a last resort, not a first resort. Within the Reserve Bank's operating framework for market operations, a reasonable benchmark is the rate we charge on the standing overnight facility, which is 25 basis points above the cash rate. This facility is called upon at various times through the year, generally as a result of small, unexpected technical hitches in the money market. For example, over the past year, it was utilised on two occasions with a total of just under $400 million drawn and for a term of no more than one day. But in a stress situation, that rate, the 25 basis points over rate, is still likely to be less than the rate prevailing in the market, as otherwise there would be no need for recourse to the central bank. So the rate on the central bank's facility is penal relative to the normal cost of liquidity, but not necessarily relative to the stressed market price of funding, a distinction which is often overlooked in these discussions. So the central bank is lending at a penalty rate. It just doesn't have to be, it's not a penalty rate relative to the circumstances at a stress situation. It is also worth noting that the central bank can apply a haircut to the value of the collateral it is lending against. That is, we will not lend dollar for dollar against the collateral, but rather against some, although it's generally fairly large, fraction of the value of that collateral. This provides protection to the central bank. But of course, the issue of value can be difficult to determine in stress situations, but, and the current market price is obviously probably not an adequate guide to the value of that collateral, but the central bank can ensure adequate protection for its liquidity provision by setting an appropriately sized haircut. That said, if the central bank really is assessing that there is indeed little concern about the quality of that collateral, this valuation issue should not be much of an issue. The final issue that often arises about the provision of liquidity support by central banks during a crisis is that of stigma. So during the crisis in some jurisdictions, banks were clearly loath to approach the central bank because of concerns about stigma. That is, the call on the central bank's liquidity facility in and of itself would exacerbate the stresses that the institution was facing. In Australia, this has been much less of an issue. Amongst other things, we naturally have to provide this liquidity support, but in our regular operations, we certainly don't see any evidence of this. So one of the key elements of our system is that a wide range of counterparties deal with us on a regular basis as part of our daily market operations. Hence, banks are accustomed to dealing with us and have a well-established relationship with us. So just to recap where we got so far, there is an important role for a central bank to play in a fractional reserve banking system as the lender of last resort. This is particularly the case in dealing with liquidity events where the central bank's provision of liquidity can be regarded as a public good. As noted, the central bank does not provide liquidity insurance for free. It is at a penal rate. Moreover, the institution must hold an adequate amount of collateral that is of acceptable quality to the central bank to lend against. So in that regard, I'll now turn briefly to the Basel liquidity standards. So the aim of the liquidity part of the Basel standards is to reduce the frequency to a very small number with which banks might actually need to seek assistance from the central bank in a liquidity event. It does so by making the size of the liquidity buffer that banks are required to hold dependent on the structure and maturity of funding. So thus, while the central bank can ultimately liquefy the balance sheet of a solvent institution in times of liquidity stress, in expectation, central bank support should be a rare event. An institution should not be careless about the funding structure on the presumption of central bank support. So the Basel standards also make determinations around the quality of assets that can be held, and they focus primarily on government debt as a liquid asset. And as has been noted a few times by both us and APRA, that's clearly not possible in Australia given the prudence of governments over a long run of years in this country. So the amount of government debt that the Australian banking system would need to hold to meet the Basel liquidity standard is actually in excess of the current stock on issue. Moreover, obviously, if the banks were to hold all the stock on issue, then the market is no longer liquid. It's somewhat self-defeating. Hence, it was announced late last year that the RBA would provide a committed liquidity facility to meet the shortfall between banks' holdings of government paper and their total liquidity needs. The banks will be charged an ongoing fee to be able to access the facility. The size of the fee is still under consideration, but the eligible assets for the facility are those currently eligible for our market operations. So having talked thus far about the fundamental importance of collateral quality in determining solvency and in determining liquidity provision by the central bank, I now just spend a few moments talking about recent developments in the asset and liability structure of the Australian banking system. So on the asset side, the most marked development has been the slowing in system credit growth. Lending for housing has slowed from the double-digit pace of the two decades until 2007 to its current pace of around 5 to 6%. This is noticeably slower than growth in household income, which was over 8% over the past year. And for those who like to agonise about debt-to-income ratios, which personally I don't, this implies a marked change in that dynamic. On the corporate side of banks' assets, growth has been very subdued, reflecting a number of different dynamics. The large investment boom currently underway is being financed in quite a different way from growth episodes in this country in the past. Companies in that sector are funding themselves from cash or directly from global financial markets. Hence, the domestic banking system is seeing much less of that business than in the past. To put it another way, intermediated business credit is likely to grow a lot slower in the period ahead than the historical relationship with GDP and investment would lead one to believe. Finally, lending conditions to the commercial property sector remain tight as banks are still reluctant to increase their exposure to that sector. So the changes in funding structure of the banking system are also quite stark. Noticeably, there has been a marked increase in the share of deposit funding. Over the past 3 years, banks' deposit funding has grown by about 15% per annum. As a result, deposits have increased by about 9 percentage points as a share of overall funding liabilities. There has been strong growth in deposit growth from households as well as from businesses, despite what you might read in various rating agency reports. The formula reflects the increased saving rate of the household sector, much of which has flowed to the banking sector. The growth of business deposits partly reflects a strong growth in corporate profitability, particularly in the resources sector. So while growth in business deposits has been considerably faster over the past 12 months, household deposit growth has still been a very robust 9% and considerably faster than asset growth. So through late 2009 and early 2010, the strength of growth in deposits reflected in part the intense competition amongst the banks for deposits. This saw the yields on deposits rise markedly, as we've documented in regular output over the past few years. But that competition appears to have levelled off a bit in recent months, yet deposit growth has still continued at a very robust pace. So I'd characterise the recent growth as being more an endogenous counterpart to the change in the growth and funding composition of the economy as a whole. And one might expect that robust endogenous deposit growth to continue for some time yet. There has also been a significant drop in the share of short-term wholesale funding, reflecting regulatory and market pressures. The share of long-term wholesale funding has correspondingly risen as banks have sought to term out the maturity of their liabilities. One noteworthy development that has generally escaped attention is that banks have raised less of this wholesale funding from offshore than has matured over the past year. That is, in net terms, the banks have actually been repaying their net foreign liabilities over the past year. So the Australian bank's use of offshore funding sources was particularly visible through 2009 and attracted a reasonable amount of attention. They were a relatively large share of global bank debt funding in that year, but that as much reflect the decrease in the number of other institutions seeking debt funding through that time. So there was a much less borrowing by banks around the world through 2009 because of the various problems they were having. The Australian banks weren't having those problems. And so as much the visibility of the Australian banks in 2009 in offshore markets reflected lack of borrowing by everyone else as much as borrowing by them. The Australian banks are a much smaller share of the global market again now, given they are raising relatively less and that banks in the rest of the world have come back to the market again. And I expect that's going to remain the case for the foreseeable future. And finally, to link back to arguments I made earlier, I'll just talk briefly about concerns surrounding the extent to which banks rely on foreign funding. So if a liquidity issue were to arise around this funding, it is of critical importance that the foreign currency denominated funding is fully hedged into Australian dollars, which indeed it is. This means that the liquidity issues for an Australian bank were to arise is in Australian dollars rather than in foreign currency. An Australian dollar liquidity issue can be addressed by the Reserve Bank. We can meet a temporary liquidity shortfall by lending Australian dollars against the bank which is undergoing that liquidity stress against its assets which are denominated in Australian dollars. The vast bulk of the Australian banking system's assets are denominated in Australian dollars, providing us with a lot of potential collateral we could lend against in a stress situation. That stands in comparison to the situation of a number of European banks that funded and still fund US dollar assets with US dollar liabilities, which have been swapped out of their local currency. When liquidity issues arose for those European banks, the ECB does not have an unlimited capacity to provide US dollars to those banks. It can only provide liquidity in its own currency. So the ECB is constrained in its inability to address those foreign currency liquidity stresses. We do not suffer those same constraints in addressing any liquidity issues should they arise for the Australian banks. So in conclusion, the main argument I've presented here today is the asset quality of a bank, which is the primary determinant of a bank's financial strength. The asset quality affects both the ability of the banks to raise funding in the market and also, importantly, has a first-order effect on the ability of the institution to obtain liquidity support from the central bank during a liquidity stress situation. So while the funding structure of a financial institution does warrant close scrutiny, an investor in that institution should pay the greatest scrutiny to the asset side of the balance sheet. So let me finish there. So a few minutes for some questions if anyone wants to fire away. Or not. Yep.
Thanks for your comments about asset quality, because I do agree that there's far too much time currently being spent on the liability side. However, how do you view the fact that 50% of the assets, I think it's actually close to 60% of the assets of the Australian banks are all in housing, yeah? And there are all those vulnerabilities around housing, however you want to couch that. And as that continues to grow, how is that going to affect?
Well, I could easily just say 40% of their assets are in business loans and there are concerns about business loans. I mean, assets are assets. If you know, not the fact that the mix 60% housing, 40% business, I don't think is anything to be of particular concern about. As you want to be just confident in the value of assets across the whole book rather than focusing on particular bits. It's also not clear to me that there's any particular problem in the asset quality on the housing book at the moment. If you look at over the last 3 years, most of the bank's provisioning and bad debt exposure has been on the corporate side of the book, particularly the commercial property side of the book, not on the residential side of the book. And indeed, by and large, if you go back through financial crises through history, mostly what brings banks undone is commercial property exposure. That tends to be the thing which kills, not, I won't use the kills, makes it difficult for banks. Anyone else? Good.
I'll just follow it on there. So if we are going to, I mean, one of our major concerns now is that banks move more and more into housing as their chief asset, and they're moving more and more out of providing funding for business. And I think you opened your speech by as you're saying that the corporates now are going more and more directly into the international global markets and sourcing for themselves. So what sort of banking system does that leave us with? A very conservative system that is cheaply funding housing and property assets, leaving our businesses all to go overseas. I mean, maybe that's a good model, but is that the model where we, how does that model fit into?
I mean, the corporates who are accessing the global credit markets are doing it because it's cheaper. I mean, they're certainly not being forced to. I mean, so I don't think that's any particular cause for concern. And so the banks are, I mean, the banks have still got some share of that market, but as the point I was making is that less than they used to. I mean, going forward, I think will be less than was historically the case. There's still the rest, you know, there's the SME sector and the rest of corporate Australia who doesn't access global capital markets. It's not a particularly large share of the Australian corporate sector which is actually able to access the global capital markets directly. There's still, I mean, if you compare the Australian financial system to the US financial system, for instance, a considerably larger share of the US financial system accesses capital markets directly. So it's, the US corporate sector is much less banked, if you want to put it that way, than the Australian financial system, or for that matter, than the European financial system, where intermediation is by far and away the main source of credit. So, and we're a long, long way away from the US situation. So I don't, I mean, it's just a question of relative rates of return. I don't see that the share of housing in banks' books is necessarily going to pick up that much from here. I mean, you're seeing business lending is starting to pick up gradually, not very much. In part, that's been because of the strength in borrowing from those people who are able to access the global market directly. So it's not clear to me that we're going to see a major shift in the structure of banks' assets from where we are now. The big shift, I think, occurred from, say, 1990 through the 80s. Everyone was concerned about the shift being the other direction, that all the lending was to businesses and not to households. Now we're swung back the other way. But I think we may well be at the point where that's about run its course.
Doctor, this is Asan Vaisada from Australian Associated Press. Just wondering what your thoughts are in terms of, are there any merits in rethinking how the RBA controls inflationary policy?
No, I mean, I'd rather just stick, to be fair, I'd rather just stick to the topic today rather than veer off into monetary policy. There are plenty of other opportunities where we talk about those sort of things, not so many times where we talk about these sort of issues. So I'd rather just stick to where we are today, please.
Okay. Just particularly, I've got a question about today. You touched on towards the end of your speech about the fact that we are well placed in terms of our currency being hedged. In terms of the ECB and the issues in Europe, and you know, the risks that we may face, because there's been some media coverage of that, with credit agencies talking about Australia being exposed. You know, in terms of the European crisis finding its way here. Just wanted you to comment on those media reports, particularly with your comments today.
At the moment, we don't see much. There's very little sign of any stress. I mean, the cost, the banks have all actually issued a fair bit over the last few weeks, notwithstanding the stresses in global markets. The price of that issuance really hasn't moved at all. So there, at this stage, at least, there is no sign of any of those stresses materialising. In fact, there's not that much sign of stresses in the interbanking market generally around the world at the moment, certainly not compared to even this time last year when the Greek situation first came to the fore, and certainly nothing like 2008.
In the BIS report, which was released on the weekend, and at least it's reported in the paper, the Australian banks are not going to be considered global and systemic. I think there's consensus that I've heard as well. But they could be domestically systemic. Presumably are, actually. So there are a small number that are very important to the Australian economy. So the regulatory apparatus would allow surcharges in this case as well. And Is this something that you want to consider?
You might want to save that one up. You can ask Wayne that one in the panel in the end. I mean, to be fair, actually, it is his territory, not mine. The only thing I would say is that the Australian... I mean, one aspect of systemic importance is intensive supervision. Now, APRA, and you can ask any of the banks and they'll certainly verify this, APRA has been intensively supervising them for a long period of time. So that part of systemic importance has been a part of the supervisory system here for a long time. I'll leave Wayne to answer any questions on capital, where that might be going. Sorry, there's one more question here.
Yeah, I was wondering if the Reserve Bank views retail deposits as stable when there is an idiosyncratic stress that affects a bank.
Well, I mean, that's actually part of the liquidity standard. There are various assumptions about runoff rates of different liabilities. I don't think, I mean, we're basically adopting, and Wayne can correct me if I'm wrong here, but we're basically adopting the Basel standards on that, which is, you know, we have some evidence now over the last few years about what happens in to runoff rates of different liabilities. The only point I would make on that, I think, I mean, deposits are often generally regarded as a good thing, and particularly short-term wholesale funding is generally regarded as a not-so-good thing. Particularly in the Australian system, where a large, you know, the superannuation system isn't very keen on deposits for whatever reason, but likes short-term wholesale paper, the stability of their investment is about the same, or certainly not materially different from that of your average retail depositor. As you said, there's an important distinction here between an idiosyncratic event and a systemic event. In an idiosyncratic event, for the system as a whole, the money's still going to end up, you know, somewhere in the system. And that said, actually, that's somewhat true for a systemic event. Unless, you know, everyone starts sticking their money under the bed, it's probably going to end up somewhere in the financial system. But I think sometimes a more stark distinction between deposits and other forms of wholesale funding is drawn than what experience and the reality actually is.
Dr. George Gabriel from Evans & Partners. Just a quick question. We've seen recently out of the UK the interim report on the bank sector where they've advocated structural separation of the banks between retail and non-retail, such that potentially the government would provide an explicit guarantee over the retail segment in exchange for a fee, and the non-retail component would be purely at risk, at market risk. Just wondering what the Reserve Bank's view on that position would be, and also tying that directly to your conversation today and your presentation today. I'm thinking about the implications in terms of the central bank providing liquidity support for an Australian bank with a large proportion of offshore assets. For example, ANZ Bank has, you know, 15 to 20% of its assets offshore. In a stress event, what would the capacity of the central bank be to provide a liquidity support against those assets? The structural separation issue ties directly into your speech today.
On the first point, it's really moot here because the Australian banks are, for all intents and, you know, if you look at the way the Vickers report defined retail banking, that is what an Australian bank is. So they have very few activities which would be outside that ring fence that the Vickers report was talking about. So, to some extent, that issue's moot. On the second point, there's still 80% of, you know, 80+% of the assets of all the Australian banks are onshore. Which, you know, if you're dealing with an event where you're needing to liquefy 80% of the balance sheet, then you're way past it. You know, you're in some pretty stressed systemic event. So the point of that is there is more than enough collateral, I think, to deal with any liquidity event that we're likely to see, particularly given the funding structure of the banks. That said, also, you know, if you look at, say, the banks with their New Zealand operations, have got New Zealand deposits funding those New Zealand operations. APRA has quite strict rules on the parental support of its subs or branches. So, you know, those things are somewhat self-contained as it is anyway.
Actually, I was going to ask Guy. I don't know if he's talking with Guy. I was just curious, Guy, if the Australian banks do get downgraded to single A or something like that, does that actually create a significant opportunity for the development of the corporate bond market for those corporates that perhaps are higher rated than the banks or equally rated to the banks? So do you And perhaps that's perhaps a global question. Do we see any potential increase in disintermediation for large corporates beyond what it currently is as a result of banks sort of being downgraded? In terms of, it'll come back to market, which is, I guess, that we expect that corporates may be able to access funding at the same level or even cheaper than the banks themselves.
Put it this way, I wouldn't go out of my way to downgrade the banking sector to develop the corporate bond market.
Sorry, that wasn't the suggestion. That was not the suggestion. I'm just saying, one of the outcomes likely that more disintermediation...
You can see that in the US at the moment, corporate bond issuance over the past 6 to 4 months has actually been very strong, much stronger than the banks are actually able to borrow, cheaper than some large chunk of the... So that certainly is something which has happened, and also to the extent that the global investment community doesn't want the bank credit risk and rather takes the corporate risk directly, then that's going to be something else. We're just going to see more disintermediation. So it's impossible, as I said, I wouldn't engineer that.
I'm saying actually it might be something that might occur as an outcome.
But I think it's going to occur. I think to some extent it's going to occur anyway. It is certainly occurring in other markets.
You're getting an element of that anyway, where lower rated corporates can actually currently raise money offshore more cheaply than AA-rated banks anyway, because of the frequency with which the banks are turning up. Mm. When you see them coming, you know, you can charge them a bit extra.
If you look, Woolies did a deal offshore, which is basically borrowing the same price as a AA-rated.
Yeah, sorry, that was the point I was really trying to make, is because when I talked to some bankers in the capital markets about the funding issues of banks, they actually pointed to this as being potentially something that is a positive. It's just that some of this might be taken up by a corporate sector.
Hi, John Keogh from the Financial Review. Thanks for your presentations, gents. Could I be very cheeky here and just briefly ask Guy, you spoke about asset quality and how there's been too much focus now putting on the funding structures and liquidity as opposed to asset quality. We've seen some recent data come out suggesting there's been a rise in mortgage delinquencies. I think from some of your comments you suggested that wasn't too much of a problem at the moment. What is your assessment of the rise in mortgage delinquencies, and what is the Reserve Bank's view on why that rise has happened?
Well, the banks have all, in their most recent financial reports, indicated some rise in delinquency rates, but from low levels to still low levels but a fraction higher. So there's not much of a... I wouldn't say that there's in any way a disturbing trend there. But there'll be... Whatever we are, the next financial stability report will go into this in much more detail, but at least as we sit at the moment, are arrears rates rising? Yeah, they probably are edging up gradually, but that's what they're doing, is edging up gradually, nothing more. So it's not by any means alarming.
Phil Lasker from the ABC. This is a question for Guy Debelle. Are you inspired by the way the Europeans are handling the Greek debt crisis? And if Greece defaulted, how big a risk do you think that is? And if Greece did default, could it trigger the sort of global market trauma that we saw when Lehman's collapsed, for example? Because a lot of people are making those sorts of comparisons.
I think one difference between now and 2008 is that there's a reasonable expectation that that's a possibility. So there was, if you go back to 2008, Lehman's was somewhat of a surprise. Probably shouldn't have been as big a surprise as it actually was, really, but nevertheless it was obviously a big surprise. You can't say that you didn't see Greece coming this time. I'm not saying that's where it's necessarily going, but I think this time around, it's reasonably well. There's some expectation. The other thing, which I think is important, which actually comes back to that graph that that was up on the screen a bit earlier, is that Lehman's was sitting there with a whole bunch of financial linkages all over the financial system. The linkages of Greece, at least financially, to the rest of the world are actually they're not that many of them, and they're fairly well known. They are those who have the direct exposure to Greek debt. And I'm not saying this means it's going to be a walk in the park by any means. All I'm saying is that the sort of the interconnectedness is not there for the sovereign. From an economic point of view, it's not a big deal. The issue is whether it is the financial interlinkages. They're reasonably well known. I think no one can really say what impact anything like that would happen if it were to happen, because a lot of the size of the impact, I think, is by and large going to be determined by the financial market reaction to it, which I think is unpredictable. But if you looked at just the straight mechanics of it, the financial linkages are nowhere near as intertwined, and from an economic point of view, it obviously is not a big deal at all.